From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Steve Samuels is a third-generation real estate developer. He's also one of many outsiders who brought their fat wallet to Hollywood. Will a big fish in Boston real estate get scrawed in Hollywood? But first, striking news. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. By now, you've heard the directors have made a preliminary deal with producers. They'll get wage and residual increases, and more to the point for the writers who are still on strike, they'd also get new jurisdiction over programs produced for online distribution. Directors will essentially make double what they're currently getting for paid downloads and new residuals for ad-supported streaming media. Producers would be allowed to use material deemed quote-unquote promotional free for a specified period of time. The kicker? Both sides agree that the deal, if approved, does not set a precedent. So, expect some serious renegotiation once the real money from digital starts pouring in. Like when I'm 60. Assuming the DGA's rank and file approve the deal, the digital provisions are groundbreaking and higher than what was offered last to the writers. But they're not as high as what the writers have been holding out for. So, what will the writers do? At the time of the taping of this show, all we know is what was said on their first pro forma press release. Quote, "The terms of the deal will be carefully analyzed and evaluated by the WGA." But you can bet that the director's deal has ratcheted up the pressure on striking scribes to settle. A possible deal with the writers couldn't come at a better time for the TV networks and their corporate masters. Despite the 12-week writer's strike, they've gotten off relatively unscathed. Sure, there's melting viewership due to repeats and reality shows, but most advertisers are not asking for their money back. Yet. That's because TV is still the easiest way to reach the largest number of eyes and ears. Case in point, the premiere of American Idol last week. It was seen by 33 million people, making it by far TV's highest-rated show. That's despite the fact that it's Idol's lowest-rated premiere in 4 years. The strike has cost TV viewers, it's taken a toll on writers and idled casts and crews. The studios, for their part, have used the opportunity to cut some jobs and eliminate Deadwood production deals. It's caused hardship on local businesses, but most importantly, the strike has cost me sleep. So let's settle this, folks, shall we? Thank you. Question. How do you make a small fortune in Hollywood? Answer. Start with a large one. Third-generation Boston real estate tycoon Steve Samuels had certainly heard that joke, but he brought his wallet to Hollywood anyway. His first experience was the straight-to-video Demi Moore supernatural thriller Half-Light, and it was a disaster. But he persisted, getting two languishing projects off the ground. Though neither In the Valley of Allah nor Michael Clayton will be giant box office hits, they've cemented his reputation as a serious producer. Though Samuels himself is staying in Boston, he's now established Samuels Media in L.A.
Steve Samuels, welcome to The Business.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So what made you decide that you wanted to even get into the movie business?
Been in the real estate business for most of my life, 25 years now, and had a good friend in the real estate business who moved into the film business, and we'd stayed very close, and he had always been talking to me about the similarities between the two businesses. And after many years of talking, I eventually decided to jump in and give it a try.
What's your friend's name, by the way?
It's Rick Hess at CAA.
Okay. Now, we should point out Rick Hess is sort of the head of independent film financing at Creative Artists Agency, probably the biggest agency in town. So not a bad friend to sort of have when you get off the Greyhound bus, so to speak. Not that you've ever, you know, been on a Greyhound bus.
It's been a while.
So what was the push?
It just was, you know, I'm a reluctant guy. You know, I like to stick to the things I know. And he's a much more aggressive guy who likes to push the envelope. And sometimes that's a good thing for me. That was something that I really needed.
You're clearly a smart guy. You made a lot of money in real estate. You must have heard that this is a business that absolutely loves, you know, to relieve fat wallets of their contents.
That's a good question. I don't presume that I'm certainly smarter than anyone who's come before me or anyone who will come after me, but I am I'm a pretty conservative guy, and I'm basically a deal junkie. In the real estate field, I go from deal to deal, and it's really all about evaluating each project on its own specific merits. And under that scenario, I'm very comfortable looking at projects and evaluating whether there's risk and how much risk and how much equity you need to get involved in and how long it takes. And so I was very comfortable taking a look at individual projects and deciding whether I get comfortable with them or not. Obviously, there's some level of risk-taking that gets in your blood from doing deals in the real estate business, and I think that carried over into film. But you know, once I saw enough projects and got an idea of triangulating where the risk and returns could be, I wanted to give it a shot.
Tell us the story of your first filmmaking experience, the making of the movie Half-Light. It all went very smoothly, from what I understand, right?
It was perfect, just like butter. Truthfully, it had all grand plans and everything made a whole lot of sense. There was a game plan that worked. All the concepts ticked and tied. And then, of course, when you get into the project, as has happened in other situations, everything began to go wrong. And
What happened? Walk us through it.
Oh, boy. We started shooting and filming in Wales prior to closing any of our bank loans and any of our debt funding. And that, in fact, didn't close until the film was finished. So I funded the entire film out of pocket. In fact, there were moments when we were using credit cards to buy film stock in Wales on an overnight basis just to get the films there. My foreign sales distributors from other countries all failed to sign documents in a timely basis. A lot of them ended up in not so great positions. My German partners were indicted. One of the producing partners from Canada was indicted. I think our Spanish partner was indicted. My banker, who was my probably most trusted confidant, George Gallegos, ended up perishing in the tsunami. Our bonding agent ended up dying of cancer. My producing partner left the set in Wales and decided to finish the movie from Los Angeles. So I was left with a first-time director and a star, Demi Moore, to work out the issues. And it was just, you know, whatever could go wrong went wrong.
And this is leaving aside the fact that torrential rains, you know, sort of destroyed all the sets.
Yeah, a couple of times. We lost a couple of sets. A couple of lighthouses that we built got destroyed. My producing partner left saying it was the worst weather conditions he'd ever been in his life, and he just couldn't operate under that situation, so he left. He said, I'll finish from Los Angeles. So it left me in a situation where I had to solve all the problems, and being a rookie at the moment, it took a whole lot of my time that I hadn't anticipated.
So the financing falls through. The sets wash away in torrential rain. One of your bankers dies in a tsunami. The other one winds up, as you put it, in not an ideal place, also known as prison. Do you get the sense that God might be trying to tell you something here, Steve?
Honestly, the way I looked at it is it looked to me like the 900-level course instead of the 100-level course. Maybe it was a message, maybe it was not, but I felt like through the process of being forced to solve other people's problems and to dig into the details that I was initially glossing over at a much higher level, I learned a whole lot of things about the business that I probably should have learned to begin with, but I learned them quickly. And I think the most important thing that stuck with me is you really just can't suspend your common sense and your intuition and all the business principles that I've used before, which is about when you make deals, you sign contracts, and you don't move forward until your contracts are signed. And the situation in filmmaking is very similar to the situation in real estate, in that you make a game plan, you lay it out, you've got a group of people that you're spending 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months with, a group of third-party contracts and players, and you have to learn to get along and mostly solve problems together. Because you wake up every day and there's a, you know, there's a new roadblock you got to get over, and you don't know what it is. You can't anticipate it, but it's all about problem solving and being able to work together and do it. And if you don't have a team that can do that, you're going to run into trouble, and whatever happens is going to end up getting accentuated and become worse rather than getting fixed. And I was a painful lesson in Half-Life that you've got to have the right team involved, and you got to have people who know how to work together and are getting along and are able to solve problems together.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the Boston-based real estate developer turned film producer, Steve Samuels. He provided vital financing for the films In the Valley of Elah and Michael Clayton.
Now, speaking of lessons learned, you know, when people walk into a casino, hopefully, they say, I'm going to gamble this much and not a penny more. And I'm wondering, did you have a rule like that for yourself, and did you break it? When you doubled your investment on Half-Life?
Absolutely. Half-Life, I had a very specific amount of money I was willing to risk. I had a very sophisticated financial game plan that I was going to execute. And I got into that trap where the film had to begin, and money had to be spent. You had to make schedules, or you're going to lose everything. We were going to lose our tax credits if we didn't move. And, of course, none of the other financial partners were signed up. And there was a stack of about 3.5 feet tall of paperwork and 15 different law firms all beating the hell out of these documents to try and get them done, which is why it took 3 months to get things signed during filming. And at that point, once I was in, there was nobody else to bail out the project. I either had to go through with it or not. And CAA had asked me before the film started, they said, listen, we're going to put Demi on a plane. We're going to send her out there. We need to know that this is a go. And my ducks were not in a row at that point, but I think that was the call, a call to arms basically saying, this thing's got to finish. We can't go out there and we can't have it fall apart and have her send her home and everybody's embarrassed. And so I took that as my my job to finish it, come hell or high water, get it done, live up to the obligations that I needed to, regardless of who did around me. And so that's what I did.
Now, in the end, you got both hell and high water.
And wind.
But you would never have done that on a real estate deal, would you?
No. I would have known better.
So why? What was it about it that sort of beguiled you and said, you mentioned, to pick up on something you said, we'd be embarrassed. Do you think that there's something about operating around movie stars, like Demi Moore's on a plane? We can't embarrass ourselves in front of Demi Moore. Like, did that sort of unmoor you from, because if this had been a real estate deal, you'd have been like, fine, unplug it.
I don't look at the star thing or the celebrity thing as anything that's ultimately driving any of the decisions I make. Whether it's a celebrity or a banker or a partner, if I make a commitment to somebody, regardless of who they are, I want to follow through on that commitment. My word is important to me, and I do that in any of my businesses. I made a commitment to CAA, made a commitment to Demi Moore, I made a commitment to hundreds of people to begin a film set, and I may have been foolish in making the commitment, but I looked at it as my job to finish it, and that's what I did and what I will do, and that's just how I look at things.
We interviewed Paul Haggis just a few weeks ago, who, of course, is the writer-director of In the Valley of Elah, movie you financed, and he was very complimentary of you, but we asked him, you know, why did Steve Samuels invest in this movie? And he honestly said, I have no idea why. You should ask Steve Samuels. So we have you on now. Why'd you do it? Why'd you put the money in it?
That's a good question, too. Of course, I did it in a partnership with Summit Entertainment, Patrick Wachsberger and his team. And both of us were very bullish on the film. We loved the script.
We should be clear here, by the way, for people listening, that Summit Entertainment is probably one of the biggest foreign sales companies. They basically take the rights to pictures and sell them in other markets to distributors overseas, and money gets generated to finance a movie that way.
That's correct.
So that's how the movie's getting made to begin with. But go on. I'm sorry.
We very much liked the script. We liked the fact that it was based on a true story, and it was a story that certainly needed to be told. Paul Haggis has some tremendous credibility as a storyteller and a writer and director, and as a guy that we really wanted to do business with. So we set about trying to find a way to get it unstuck at the studio. And
now, when you say it was stuck at the, or, you know, when you say you had to get it unstuck, it implies it was stuck at a studio. In this case, it was New Line. They felt it was a risky movie.
They did, and they, you know, there's always degrees of risk. It's always about what's the budget and who are the stars and how long does it take and what's the risk involved in getting it completed on time. And so all those little variables go into, is it a risky movie and is it not? And those are the things that you play with along the edges to make it a less risky movie. And so through negotiation, both with the studio and the foreign sales distributors and Paul and his team, you know, we were able to shape all the edges of the film to the point where it made sense to go.
Now, I'm hearing two different things here. I want to ask you specifically, did you think that you were going to make money on this movie?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Because it sounds like, to me, the studio had reluctance about it, and so you sort of stepped in and sort of filed off the sharp edges, right? You sort of figure out ways to mitigate the risk. But it sounds more like you're taking a path of, I really love this script, I really love Paul Haggis as a storyteller, I really want to tell this story, I really want to make this movie, and we'll shave off some of the risk, we'll get rid of, you know, we'll do foreign sales, we'll do whatever sort of financial bag of tricks that financiers can bring to bear. But it seems like it's a different approach than, say, real estate, where it's like, we're going to build something, we're going to make a ton of money on it, and then we're going to build something else. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think it
doesn't seem like this is a money-making enterprise. It seems like it's a risk mitigation enterprise, and that if it makes money after that, fine. Is that a fair distinction to make?
That's a really good way to put it, because you never know if you're going to make money with something or not. It's clearly a risky business, and as opposed to real estate, you know, you start a real estate project, and you may start with some of the same elements of risk, where you you can tie up a piece of land, a cornfield at the middle of an intersection, and it's worth what a cornfield's worth until you bring something to it. In effect, if you're building a shopping center, you bring an anchor tenant to it, somebody like a Bloomingdale's or a Saks or a Neiman Marcus or something, and all of a sudden there's a tremendous amount of value created there, and you can lease an entire shopping center around an anchor. It had no value until you added another ingredient. And then you have a process. You have a process to build, to lease, to manage, to finance, and you execute it. If you execute in the real estate business, I shouldn't say virtually certain, but you're pretty certain what your value is going to be when you're finished. You know what the building's going to be worth. You know what the income stream is basically like. And barring catastrophic issues with our economy, you have a pretty good idea of what kind of value you're creating. In the film business, you go through the same kind of process where you have a script that might be great, and it doesn't have a whole lot of value until you add those other critical elements to it, like a great director and a great actor and a budget that works and a schedule that works. And it's very similar to a real estate process. But even at the end in the film, you deliver a quality film, you deliver a film like Valley of Allah that really you're really proud of, it doesn't play in the marketplace. So you don't have that certainty of value. And so it's not an enterprise where you can go in saying, hey, I'm going to make a lot of money on this, or I'm sure. I like to go in and pick projects that I'm passionate about, that I love, with people that I really respect and that are logical and that we can get along and solve problems together. And I'll set up the financial model so that I cover the downside. Maybe that's the best way to put it. That's where you were going before. And so betting on the quality and the process of the filmmaker and the actors and the directors to get it done, and that there'll be great upside if you do it well. But if it doesn't go so well, you're not going to get killed. And that's the philosophy I use.
After a short break, more with Hollywood newbie Steve Samuels. He's a Boston-based real estate developer who provided vital financing for the films In the Valley of Elah and Michael Clayton. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. For years, Rick Hess, a bigwig in independent financing at Creative Artist Agency, talked to his old friend Steve Samuels about investing in Hollywood. Samuels, who'd worked in real estate with Hess back east,
could see how developing a plot of land into a mall was not unlike developing the plot of a screenplay into a film. A confessed deal junkie, Samuels would find out how different the two worlds were when he invested in the 2004 disaster Half-Life.
Your son's waiting for you.
On the swings. He's been waiting for you. He told me.
My son?
This isn't some kind of game, is it?
Rachel, there's something wrong.
My son drowned. He follows you everywhere.
Undeterred, he went on to provide vital financing for two of this year's critical hits, In the Valley of Allah and Michael Clayton. Though neither film will do big box office, they've cemented his reputation as a serious producer.
You're often quoted about how the two businesses are similar. And, you know, along those lines, you know, shopping centers don't get pregnant. You know, malls don't go into rehab. You know, office buildings won't, you know, not come out of their trailer or throw a fit or, you know, whatever. On a very micro level, what are the major differences between doing business in real estate and doing business in Hollywood?
In the real estate business, the majority of the time, the people that you're doing business with or negotiating with, all the parties that you may encounter between, you know, contractors and financiers or lenders or tenants or architects or engineers, they're all basically motivated by one thing in the end. It's dollars. You kind of know where everybody's coming from. I think clearly in the film business, it's a different animal than that, and a lot of the people that drive the bus in the film business, they're not necessarily motivated by money. They're motivated by things much more near and dear to their heart and things that are not so easily understood by third parties. And so it makes it a little more complicated.
Give me an example. I mean, people are what? They're after an Oscar? They're after reputation?
They're after an Oscar. They're after you know, the right type of film for their career at the moment. They're after a space and time that needs to get filled. They're after working with a specific director or a specific actor. It's combinations of people. A lot of it is an emotional attachment to material and the characters. And clearly you don't have any of that in the real estate business.
If I'm hearing you correctly, Hollywood's a far more emotional business than a you know, an office building kind of business.
Yeah, I would use the word passionate.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, there's a lot of passion involved in filmmaking and from all aspects of it. That's not to say people aren't passionate about the real estate business, but my father always used to say to me, you don't fall in love with a piece of real estate. You know, it's economics. It's a building. It's about money. You can buy them. You can sell them. You can trade them. You don't fall in love with them. It's about economics, and film is very different.
Is your father still alive?
Yes.
So what does he tell you about the movie business? Did he give you any advice going in?
Yeah, like, are you crazy? Those are the conversations you really don't want to have with a father who has been a mentor in the real estate business most of your life, who kind of, you know, has a very specific and organized and narrow view of how you do things to get successful. When you say, hey, I'm going to try a new venture, and my father has been one to try other ventures himself. He got off into food businesses and organic food businesses and things like that, and always ended up coming back to real estate and coming back with the mantra of you should really stick to what you know. So with a guy who has a bias like that, when you come and say, hey, I'm gonna try and do some films, clearly with the reputation of the history of the film business of sucking money out of people's pockets who don't know, that's like a father looking at his son going, what's the matter with you? But here we go.
You're still based in Boston.
Yes.
Is that deliberate?
Yes.
Why?
It's a good place to live. It's a good place to raise a family. I'm still running a significant real estate business with projects that I'm committed to doing for, you know, a decade or so. And so I'm still very committed there. It's hard to come out here and get involved on a, you know, incremental basis in this business. You really have to get absorbed in it. It is an issue for me. Time management is hard, and jumping between businesses is even harder. And I think
you don't care to be absorbed.
I don't care to be absorbed. No, I like being diverse, and I like having a lot of irons in the fire. Something I was taught very young. In the context of the real estate business, it's nice to have five or six projects going at once so that you're not living and dying by the successes of the failures of one. That can be quite an emotional roller coaster. If one's going great, you can be really happy, and one's going poorly, you get down in the dumps. But if you got four or five going and you're diverse, you can stay on a much more even keel. And I feel the same way about the film business.
When you're making these projects, I'm wondering if you have the long view, not only of the project, but of you and your career here in Hollywood, your sort of reputation in Hollywood. And we talk about mitigating downside. Do you ever think, well, look, we've sort of plugged the holes. We can't lose that much money on this thing. And long term, making a movie like In the Valley of Ella, even if it makes, you know, I don't know, $1 million or something, we did it with Paul Haggis. We did it with Tommy Lee Jones. You know, these are Oscar-winning guys. It's a movie that I'm never going to be embarrassed to say I made that. And creative people are going to just worship the ground I walk on because I made someone's passion project happen. I mean, was that in your mind at all? Are you thinking like...
Well, I think the most prevalent thing in my mind is it's something that I'm going to be proud of. And when you read the words on the page and you put the thing together, you want to be able to look at it. At least I want to look at it. I want my family to look at it, my friends to look at it and say that was, you know, that was a good contribution. It's important to me to make passion projects for guys like Gilroy or Haggis because it's important to get those things done. And in this business, they don't always get done in the normal studio system. And so I feel that there's a role there that I can have.
And that playing that role makes you a more powerful guy. That is, you're the guy who makes passion projects happen for top talent. Is that the mantle you want to have?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be something I would be very proud of.
How long can you keep going like this? I mean, how long can you, you know, lose a little money on these films? Does it matter at all?
Oh, it certainly matters. I'm certainly financially motivated. I'm not a super rich guy out here just to waste money and to spend time on it. I'm in it to make a living and to build a business and to do it right. And I'll go slowly if I have to. It does matter. And it's important to me. It's a learning process when you don't have 25 years of experience in a business. You have to do a lot of listening. And I think one of the things that struck me the most is when I'm in, on a personal level, when I'm in a real estate transaction or in the real estate business, people know me. They understand what I've done. They understand that I have a history. They know how I think. They know my family. You know, I have some kind of basis that comes before me. And it helps and it hurts, but mostly it helps because you don't really have to work as hard. You don't have to dig in as deep. You don't have to think every night about what you just heard in a meeting and what was really said. And you don't have to learn a whole new language. And one of the things that's been most stimulating for me in the film business is that I'm starting from scratch and starting over as a rookie. And there's a huge absorption period of just soaking in not only the lingo and the processes, but you have to get a good sense of the history of what's worked before and what hasn't worked before, because everybody makes decisions in this business based on the context of what's come before them. And if you don't have that down in your core, you got to think about it or you have to ask a lot of questions. And so I find myself being much more challenged here than I'd ever been, and I find that my ears have grown a lot bigger than my mouth, and that's, I think, a helpful thing.
Well, Steve Samuels, it was a great pleasure to have you in. Steve Samuels is, of course, the producer of movies like Michael Clayton and In the Valley of Ella. He joined us at our studios in Santa Monica. Steve, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you very much, Claude. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Rodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.